Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to welcome you all to this year's Alistair Barclay lecture. This lecture is given each year in memory of an LSE student who lost his life in the Lockerbie outrage. We're very pleased to welcome his parents here and to express again our appreciation to them for dedicating this series of lectures in his name. And this year, we honour his memory with a lecture to be given by Andrew Clapham. Mr. Clapham started this phase of his life by working on his doctorate at the European University Institute in Florence. And after he completed his doctorate there, he went on, in fact, to become executive director of their academy there on European law. And he has since then developed a very considerable interest in and deep knowledge of human rights law, and indeed has been one of those working at the interface of European law and human rights law. In that context, he has co-edited three volumes with Professors Cassese and Weiler of the European University on the human rights challenge in the European Union. Since that time, he has been closely associated with Amnesty International, working particularly as Amnesty's representative at the United Nations in New York. And it's there that Andrew and I see each other rather regularly, because I go out for a month each year for work on the Committee on Human Rights under the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And Andrew Clapham is always there providing information and facts and data to the committee members to supplement any knowledge that they feel in need of, and indeed to lobby and make representations to us on Amnesty's behalf about points that they believe should be in focus. He has recently completed a book published by Oxford University Press entitled Human Rights in the Private Sphere. I show you this copy and tell you that no home is complete without one. And what it is about particularly is about the idea that human rights should not be limited, as we have traditionally thought, to the relationship between individuals and government, but that it also has particularly something to say in the relationship between individuals as such. The lecture tonight, entitled Privatization of Human Rights, I imagine is going to mean privatization in that particular context, but then again, I may be wrong in that. We now look forward with interest to what Andrew Clapham will say.
Thank you very much, Professor Higgins, for that kind introduction. I'm very honoured to have been asked to give this Alistair Barclay memorial lecture. I should, I suppose, explain straight away what I mean by this rather provocative title, The Privatization of Human Rights. I'm trying to highlight six different issues. Firstly, the importance of applying human rights law to the actions of private bodies. A traditional reading of human rights law would state that human rights only binds governments, it only constricts governmental agents. I'd like to challenge this assumption. For example, I'll suggest that human rights law actually covers the sphere of complaints by workers against their employers, by children against their parents, by women against their abusers, by tenants against their landlords, and by victims of racism against their attackers. In short, all the areas which are currently considered the private sphere and therefore insulated from the world of human rights. Secondly, I have used the term privatization in this lecture, to highlight the fact that many of the traditional places where human rights violations take place are actually being privatized. It's important that the old guarantees, which protect the individual from the abuse of state power, would be equally applied to these newly privatized concerns. So, for example, the famous case of Mr. Malone, who was an antique dealer who had his telephone tapped. He complained to the European Court of Human Rights about this, and the metering by the post office. Now, metering means that the post office takes down the numbers that you call and passes that information on to the police. Now, the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg held that this constituted interference with Mr. Malone's privacy, even though the post office were just recording the messages sent to them as the commercial operator. By the time the case was actually decided, telephone services in the United Kingdom had been privatized, and this was all being done by British Telecom. So the point is, the abuser of human rights had actually been privatized and theoretically taken out of the sphere of traditional human rights law. Similarly, if you take the case of a complaint about aircraft noise near Heathrow, Heathrow was a public body at the time of the complaint, and yet by the time the case had wound its way through the system in Strasbourg, airports had been privatized. So again, the scene of the human rights violation is now private. When I started thinking about this, I used to raise the hypothetical possibility with people that they'd say, well, all this is a bit, you know, hypothetical. I mean, it's not really a question of privatization. I'd say, well, maybe one day you might have a privatized prison in the United Kingdom. And people would laugh and say, no, you must be crazy. And of course, now it is there. The world's prison outside Hull is a private prison. It has patients. It has inmates. And as you know, private security companies like Group 4 are now in charge of moving prisoners around the United Kingdom. And indeed, Securicorps have been asked to guard immigrants off the coast of Kent in a Sealink boat called the Prince William. So in all these cases, there have been allegations of mistreatment, but in all these cases, the area of activity which was traditionally carried out by the state has been privatized. I'm suggesting that the law which protected people from abuse by the post office, by Heathrow Airport, by the prison systems, or state hospitals, where you have mental patients this time, remain just as necessary as these functions get privatized in the UK. But more seriously, if privatization plays a big role in the United Kingdom, it plays an even more crucial role in Central and Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Union. The drive to privatization in those countries is so fundamental that the human rights slogans of the 80s, where the demands were human rights for all, have been replaced by graffiti on the walls of Sofia and Bucharest, now reading privatization now. The third point I wanted to raise is that many of the organizations and individuals who threaten human rights are found in the private sphere, and therefore human rights activists have to turn some of their attention to this sphere too. I would say they have to privatize some of their priorities. What do I mean? Historically, most of the time, human rights activists have concentrated, for example, on misuse of information held by them, by the state secret service. Nowadays, private information and profiles are kept by private companies on computer disk and sold off to prospective employers and insurance companies. The apparatus of surveillance and information collection is now available to all. Many of these threats now take place in an exclusive private sphere, and we will have to rely much more on private whistleblowers as opposed to the state. Now, traditionally, human rights groups have concentrated on the state apparatus. Of course, this was only ever part of the real human rights story. But if mental hospitals, prisons, broadcasting, electronic databases grow up in the private sphere, we'll have to rely on private groups and trades unions to patrol that sphere. Because ideologically, the governments which are seeking to privatize those areas are going to be the last to introduce new regulation and new watchdogs at the governmental level. Fourth, I'd like to come to a completely separate aspect of the privatization of human rights at an international level. As part of the United Nations response to the tragedy in Yugoslavia, they have appointed a special rapporteur on human rights, Mr. Mazowiecki, the former Polish Prime Minister. And he's been faced with the task of collecting information about rape, human rights abuses, killings in the former Yugoslavia, but he's not been able to get the necessary resources from the United Nations. It's now apparently the case that the millionaire George Soros has provided him with a credit card so that his expenses will be covered whilst on mission. Another aspect of privatizing human rights. Corporate funding for UN peacekeeping cannot really be that far away. I mean, one could imagine blueberries with Pepsi stenciled on the back. Now, when I was thinking of this, I actually threw that in as a bit of an offhand remark, but the day before I left New York, I was discussing this issue, and somebody told me that the UN has entered into agreement with Gold Star, the South Korean television company, for $5 million to fund various UN activities. So as the UN gets more involved with North Korea, I think some of these issues can become obviously a little controversial. Fifthly, there's a need to apply some human rights and political techniques to the protection which human rights ought to offer to the private sphere, where women in particular remain forgotten and ignored. No interference in domestic affairs is a refrain which one often hears in human rights debates. The effect at the national level is that the issues of violence against women, childcare, sexual discrimination in the workplace, and child abuse remain disconnected from the human rights discourse. This, in turn, is to denigrate these forms of abuse and relegate them to the second division, the Premier League being reserved for the rights of man. Privatizing human rights means recognizing the violent abuses suffered by women and girl children every day. Sixth, denying the applicability of human rights law to the private sphere can have quite concrete and detrimental effects, and paradoxically mean that human rights are seen much more as a tool against the weak than a shield against oppression. What do I mean? In Canada, the way the courts have divided up the public from the private in their application of human rights law means that in one case, a union wanted to rely on freedom of expression as contained in the Canadian Bill of Rights to complain that they were allowed to picket a secondary employer. And they said, well, it says here in our Bill of Rights that we have freedom of expression. They went to court, and the court said, no, you only have freedom of expression against the government. This employer is a private body. Freedom of expression doesn't count. So the unions went away and thought, well, okay, so the Bill of Rights doesn't apply to what we do. But then, subsequent cases, individuals brought a case against the unions saying, you are using our money for political ends. And the courts found against the union, because they said, well, this is a case of legislation, and the individual is challenging the legislation and saying that his freedom of expression is not being observed by the unions. So unions in Canada found themselves in the situation that while they couldn't use the Bill of Rights, it was being used against them. Similarly, women in Canada tried to use the Bill of Rights to complain about abuse by their husbands or abuse by absent fathers not paying their childcare, and so on, and were told, no, the Bill of Rights doesn't apply in the private sphere. Yet when men challenged legislation which provided for maternity benefits, childcare, and so on, the legislation was struck down as discriminatory. So, and this is more than theoretical in that at the beginning, if I've understood correctly, there were more victories by men against legislation protecting women than there were wins by women against discrimination by the state. So the point is not that judges are actually biased against organized labor and women, but rather that having a private-public distinction allows welfare state legislation enacted to protect those groups to be annulled, whilst the general inequality and indignity which promoted the legislation in the first place cannot be attacked. And the situation continues to be exacerbated by having the public-private divide. Now, I'd like to concentrate on one small aspect of all this, and that's the constitutional aspect in the United Kingdom. Obviously, you could approach it from a feminist perspective or from the perspective of industrial relations or a number of other perspectives, but I started looking at this in the context of whether or not the United Kingdom should have a Bill of Rights. And in the early 70s, it was quite clear that there was a lot of confusion around whether such a Bill of Rights would actually only cover your relationship with the state or would also cover relationships between individuals. And some of the early Labour Party attempts to have a Bill of Rights were clearly a response to the fact that they felt individuals needed protecting from private power. And I'd like to read a brief passage from a speech by Labour MP Peter Archer in the House of Commons. And it gives a flavour of the political feeling at the time, even if the images are more reminiscent of the 1920s than the dawning of the computer age. This is him. "There are times when we all have the feeling of being lashed to a railway track in the path of an onrushing train. It may be this is one of the prices that we have to pay for the privilege of living in a technological age. We, on this side of the House, take the view that there are other relationships, not only the relationships between the individual and government, which can also blight lives, and which for many individuals can result in tragedy. Very serious distress can be caused by an employer, by a landlord, or by a neighbour. Not all wrecked lives are caused by governments. Sometimes to safeguard individuals from this kind of danger may entail giving more power to government officials." And he goes on. "The wicked landlord of a Victorian melodrama was a frightening enough individual, but at least the heroine could talk to him and, in the last resort, could appeal to his better nature. These days, the tenant who seeks to obtain the reversal of a decision from his landlord will be lucky enough if he can find anyone who admits to having power to alter such a decision, because usually it is a big property company." That was in 1971. By 1977, there had been so much friction between the courts and the trades union movement that it was felt giving judges new control over either the sphere of labour relations or just generally to undermine governmental legislation would result in losses for the left and the losses for organised labour. And they became very suspicious, the left in general became very suspicious of individual rights and allowing judges new powers. But by the end of the 80s and the first half of this decade, the debate had shifted again. And now the question is, people want to do down the road in the Strand what is currently done in Strasbourg. I.e., instead of having to take your case to the European Court of Human Rights and cross the Channel and so on, you would be able to go to the British courts and say, my rights have been violated. This is obviously, I'm sure it's well known to you. But the question then still arises, would we be able to take cases against other private individuals? Would you be able to take a case against IBM or Esso, or would it only be the government? Now, because to go to Europe, the defendant in Europe is always a government because it's an intergovernmental treaty and that's the way it's set up, that has rather skewed the debate about what should be the scope of human rights law or a Bill of Rights in this country. And I'd like to just point out that human rights law and international law doesn't have to only attach to states. If you take the international crime of genocide as defined in the 1948 Genocide Convention, it covers acts even when committed by private individuals. So in Rwanda, if prosecutions are ever brought for genocide, whether or not the perpetrator is a government official is irrelevant. The only question is their genocidal intent. Now, a few years after the Genocide Convention was drafted, they started drafting the treaty which Professor Higgins referred to earlier, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And even at that time, people were aware that these human rights treaties ought to cover the private sphere. And I'll read a quick passage from the preparatory works, the Travaux Préparatoires. And I'm quoting, "Although a suggestion was made that freedom of assembly should be protected only against governmental interference, it was generally understood that the individual should be protected against all kinds of interference in the exercise of this right." Now, the Human Rights Committee, as we heard before, actually looks at how governments implement their obligations under this treaty. And I have to say that it's often a great pleasure to see Professor Higgins tear into governments on their human rights record and put these questions to them. But I hope we can maybe encourage the committee to ask them more questions about what they are doing in fulfilling their obligations to ensure that human rights are respected in the private sphere. And I'd encourage you all to write to Geneva and make your suggestions. Now, the Human Rights Committee, not apart from examining the reports of governments, also make general comments on each each article under the covenant. And these are intended to be an interpretation of the scope of these articles. So I'd like to read an example. In 1992, they looked at the article which prohibits inhumane, degrading treatment or torture. And in their general comment on this article, they say that cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment has to be prohibited. And then it says, and I'm quoting, whether inflicted by people acting in their official capacity, outside their official capacity, or in a private capacity. So clearly the Human Rights Committee have defined that the article in international law which prohibits torture and degrading treatment covers not only people acting as governmental agents, but also people acting in a private capacity. And similarly, they have general comments on mental institutions, which again have been phrased in such a way as to cover all mental institutions and not just those run by the government. I'll return now to Strasbourg and examine very quickly some of the cases which have arisen there, and perhaps start appropriately enough in the context of this memorial lecture with complaints concerning killings of civilians by armed political groups. There have been a number of cases of widows and relatives brought against the United Kingdom in connections with killings by the IRA and Protestant paramilitaries. And the European Commission on Human Rights held that these cases cannot just be dismissed because the killing took place by a private group. And they have gone on to discuss the extent to which the United Kingdom government has taken enough steps to ensure that these things don't happen. Even though no individuals have won their cases in Strasbourg, the Commission now says that the convention does cover these non-governmental actors. In the case of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, which sits in Costa Rica and covers the Americas, there has been a case which has gone all the way to the court called Rodriguez against Honduras. And again, they found that international responsibility can be found for a state even when the illegal act, and in this case it was a disappearance by a death squad, is the act of a private person or somebody who's yet to be identified. They say the state has two duties: a duty of due diligence to prevent the abuse in the first place, and secondly, a duty to respond to the abuse and compensate the victims. Now, another aspect of this question is where somebody is about to be extradited or deported, and they complain that when they are going to the other country, they will be attacked by a private organization, not by the state, but by another group of terrorists or by a group of private individuals. And again, this has arisen in a concrete case. So in one case, a Turkish national who was a member of an extreme right-wing party, which had been feuding with a left-wing party, was about to be sent back to Turkey. In another case, there was the founder of the Association of Revolutionary Students of Turkey, and he was feared that he would be subject to torture when he went back because of his enemies within the group. Now, in this last case, the European Commission on Human Rights stated, a person's extradition may, in certain circumstances, be contrary to the convention, notably Article 3, the prohibition on torture, where there is serious reason to believe that the individual will be subjected in the receiving state to treatment prescribed by this article. This may be so even if the danger does not emanate from public authorities for whom the receiving state is responsible. So again, a broad recognition that even if you're being sent to somewhere where the threat on you is by private groups, that is still covered by international human rights law. I now come to a British case, some of you may know this one, about British private schools. And for years it's been very unclear as to whether this is covered by human rights law. And I'm going to talk about corporal punishment, whether beating people in private schools is a violation of human rights. The case is called Jeremy Costello Roberts, and he was 7 years old when he received his fifth demerit mark for talking in the corridor. The other demerits had been for similar offences and for being late for bed. He was a boarder at a private preparatory school in Devon, and he'd been there for about a month. And the headmaster decided that the only answer to this lack of discipline was three whacks with a gym shoe on Jeremy's bottom. And the punishment was then carried out 3 days later. His mother wrote to the school saying she didn't want her son punished in this way, and the school reacted by asking her to withdraw her son from the school. Now, in the United Kingdom, it's a defense to the civil or criminal charge that the person who assaults a child is a teacher administering reasonable punishment. And although previous cases had come to Strasbourg, these had involved state schools. And Strasbourg had found that corporal punishment in state schools was indeed a violation of the European Convention. And the United Kingdom had introduced legislation called the Education Act No. 2 in 1986. But that act only covered the state sector. It left completely insulated the private sector. So the court had to decide whether they were going to privatize this human right not to be beaten at school. Now, the court referred to the duty of the state to secure the right to education, and they said that discipline is all part of that. And in an important paragraph, the court then states, the state cannot absolve itself of this responsibility by delegating its obligations to private bodies or individuals. And the treatment complained of could, in theory, engage the responsibility of the United Kingdom government. But the court found by 5-4 that the punishment wasn't actually as severe enough to be called inhumane and degrading. They found there were no severe, long-lasting effects. But the joint opinion of the four is interesting, the four dissenters. They said the ritualized character of the punishment was striking. The three-day delay and the formal nature of the punishment meant that it was actually degrading. What they said is, had the punishment occurred on the spur of the moment, perhaps it would have been permissible. So in the words of the British judge, the case was on the borderline. But they were keen to say that the actual finding of no violation could not be taken to approve in any way the retention of corporal punishment as part of the disciplinary regime of a school. So one can only guess that had the pupil been caned or given much tougher whacking, it would have been considered a violation of human rights. So in principle, beating somebody in a private school is a violation of human rights, even though that case was lost. But they also said something about the whole process of privatization, which is interesting. The four in the minority said this: a state can neither shift prison administration to the private sector and thereby make corporal punishment in prisons lawful, nor can it permit the setting up of a system of private schools which are run irrespective of convention guarantees. So it's covered. But then they go on again to talk about the public-private distinction. And they suggest, and it's the first time I've seen this, they suggest that actually the public-private distinction adds to the degradation. This is what they said. Reflecting developments throughout Europe, corporal punishment was made unlawful for pupils in state and certain independent schools. Given that such punishment was being progressively outlawed elsewhere, it must have appeared all the more degrading to those remaining pupils in independent schools whose disciplinary regimes persisted in punishing people in this way. So Strasbourg, punishment in school, private prisons, all covered by the Strasbourg Court of Human Rights. The state has a theoretical duty to protect individuals also from terrorists' assault on the right to life. But what about abuses in the private spheres which have been guarded from state interference for years and years by liberals? If terrorists and private teachers can be human rights violators, what about boyfriends and bosses? Now, these issues have also arisen in Strasbourg, and the debate there should illustrate the tension which surrounds entering these last two private spheres. In a case called X and Y against the Netherlands, a 16-year-old mentally handicapped girl had been sexually abused by the son-in-law of the director of the private nursing home where she lived. Now, there was a gap in Dutch law so that neither the father of the girl, Mr. X, or the girl, Y, could bring a criminal prosecution against the man who had assaulted her. Although there were civil remedies which were available, they said these weren't sufficiently protective and the delays in bringing them would be so traumatic that it wasn't an effective remedy. Now, the European Court of Human Rights said that the article which respects privacy was relevant and had been violated by the Dutch government. They said that in addition to the negative obligations of the state, there may be positive obligations to ensure an effective respect for your private and family life. And then in an important passage, they say, these obligations may involve the adoption of measures designed to secure respect for private life, even in the sphere of relations between individuals. And Miss X was awarded £1,000 and the criminal law in the Netherlands was changed. Now, this case, I would suggest, represents quite a big breakthrough in the whole of the human rights jurisprudence. in that they're saying that it cuts straight across the traditional approach, and it would cover cases which feminists for many years now have been saying should be covered by human rights law. And as Catherine MacKinnon recently put it, the role of international law has been largely, in Isaiah Berlin's sense, negative. It could be more, but it fosters human rights less through mandating governmental interference than through enforcing governmental abstinence. In other words, if your human rights are going to be violated, pray it is by someone who looks like a government and that he already acted and acted wrong. Now, the implications of the case I described before are quite far-reaching, because it would mean that marital rape, child abuse, domestic violence, these all become human rights issues which can be eventually discussed in either the European Court of Human Rights or in the national court level as a human rights issue. Now, what about the workplace? As I said before, trade union movements have been traditionally suspicious about individual human rights in this area. They felt that there was a case where there were three workers who went to Strasbourg, to the European Court of Human Rights, to complain that their freedom of expression was being violated because they were being forced to join a union they didn't want to join. And they won against the United Kingdom, and the labour law legislation had to be readjusted. Now, in that case, they were employed by British Rail, a nationalised industry, but since then it's been decided that this also applies in the private sphere. Now, it's important to look at these last two cases of what I've called abuses by boyfriends and bosses, because it points to the limits of what you can do in so-called privatising human rights. Because in deciding to criminalise sex with that 16-year-old mental patient, one would have to weigh up the risks of what the government called depriving these categories of individual of all sexual contact, which might be at variance with their own rights to private life. And similarly, if you privatise the area of trade union relationships, what about the rights of those individuals who want to associate together and create an effective union? So in trying to privatise human rights, you could end up publicising the private and bringing in a whole new round of state interference where you don't want it. But if we are going to be honest about avoiding the trip to Strasbourg and having human rights at the national level, we would have to agree that the human rights are applicable against other individuals. We just need a framework to work out what the limits of that are to make it work and to make it work reasonably. Obviously, you can't transpose human rights into absolutely every private sphere fundamentally as a sort of fundamentalist thing, but there must be a way forward. I mean, okay, does freedom of information mean that I can find out information about my rivals? Obviously not. There's, at the philosophical level, there's going to be a big difference between human rights against the state and human rights against individuals. And the reason is actually quite simple. When one claims a right to information from the state has to rely on state-like limitations. They can rely on national security or public order. But when one invokes your right against another private individual, that other individual has human rights. The state has no human rights. It's not human. So the individual can rely on privacy. I want to see what's in your diary, but you can say I have a private right to privacy to retain what's in my diary. So it's obviously going to be problematic, and I'd like to try and finish by suggesting two ways out of this conundrum as to how you resolve it. At the national level, I suggest that if you're faced with a direct clash of human rights between two private bodies, we should stop and look at what the aim of the human right is in question. If the overriding aim is to protect a victim's dignity, then that victim would have to be protected from everybody, whether they're public or private or mixed. It matters not if the body has public functions, is financed by the state, or is just simply a private individual. If it's a question of inhumane and degrading treatment, this is just as damaging whether it's meted out by a security corps guard or a public policeman. On the other hand, if the aim of the right is the protection of democracy, then for the individuals to rely on that right against another private body, the action has to relate somehow to the public domain and the sphere of the public. And I'll try and illustrate this with an example. The example would run like this. Pro-choice activists in the abortion debate want to invoke freedom of expression, and they want to go into a church and interrupt a service to demonstrate and use their freedom of expression. Now, the aim of the freedom of expression in this context is democratic debate. So we would have to look at what I just called the public domain test and see, is this the sphere of the public or the public domain? And I would say because the church service is not really the public domain, then the application of human rights in the private sphere would not demand that they automatically get to use their freedom of expression inside the church. And to give a counterexample, if you had a company town, which currently exists in the United States, where the whole town is owned by a private corporation, and there you have workers or trade unions that want to demonstrate in the shopping precinct to express their concern about something, and the company says no, no demonstrations, and there's nowhere else they can demonstrate, then democracy demands access by all to the marketplace of ideas, and that they would be able to invoke their freedom of expression. So that would be one way it could work at the national level. Similarly, at the international level, you will have to sort out, not every private violation is going to trigger state responsibility. If one man murders another or a baby brother hits his sister, we're not going to assume that there's going to be state responsibility for human rights. I think you could have something like what I would call a but-for test. So in other words, is it likely that but for the absence of appropriate state measures, the violation could have been prevented or compensated? In most cases, legislation will exist which protects private individuals and they'll be able to sue another private individual. But in the spheres which have been privatized, or the sphere which has been forgotten or sealed off or considered merely domestic affairs, it might be necessary and important that the victims could actually use human rights law and all the protection that that brings to ensure extra protection against abuses of their human rights. So, having made the case for such a privatization of human rights, I wouldn't like to leave you underestimating the opposition of this happening quickly, even at the national level. In Canada, the United States, and Hong Kong, all their bills of rights are held not to cover the private sphere. Political theorists and in most political science schools and working in government are stuck with the theory of John Locke and the French Declaration of 1789 and the idea of a contract between citizens and the state. And even human rights organizations and civil liberties groups, even the one I work for, Amnesty International, we concentrate on the violations by the state or the armed opposition groups that want to become states and governments. Even here in the United Kingdom, the latest proposals to have a Bill of Rights concentrate on governmental officials and wouldn't cover the private sphere. And there's generally a rather sort of dogmatic and doctrinaire, even chauvinistic attitude to extending human rights in this way. And I'd like to finish by reading part of a letter written to the Maltese Sunday Times complaining about a constitutional court ruling there that the prohibition on inhumane and degrading treatment as found in their Bill of Rights applied not only to state actors but also to private actors as well. And this will give you an idea of the opposition, and I'll quote it now. The decision can only bring a regrettable involution of human rights and a trivialization of the formidable concept of protection against abusive state action. The teenager whose love letters are opened by her mother now has an action for human rights redress, just like the political dissenter whose correspondence is spied on by the political police. The wife who is beaten up by her husband henceforth has an action for fundamental rights redress on an equal footing with the political detainee who is beaten up by his interrogators, which, with all due respect, pulls inside out the very concept of human rights. End of quote. But with all due respect to the author of the letter, Dr. Bonello, the conclusion I'd like to leave you with today is that putting a woman who is beaten up by her husband on an equal footing with a political detainee who is beaten up by his interrogators does not trivialize human rights. Rather, it enriches the whole question of human rights. It's simply a question of where you're standing. To privatize human rights helps shift human rights from the sphere of political rhetoric into the spheres of daily reality. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. We now move into a discussion mode. It's a tremendous temptation to do a sort of out-of-hours LLM class right here on what we've heard. I am going to take advantage of my position in the chair to set the ball rolling. What I want to ask Andrew Clapham is this, whether what he's saying is really more than moving the furniture around in this sense. States have to, they are required to by the various international instruments, ensure human rights within their jurisdiction. And a lot of what you said and some of the examples you gave is covered by individuals or groups acting essentially as agents of state in state functions. So that, for me, would answer very easily the questions about schools and prisons. Necessarily, there remains a state responsibility for those, even if they have chosen to have those state functions carried out by others not in the regular service of the state. More problematic, I think, is when you have individuals engaged in activities that you describe as rights denials against other individuals. We know, and you gave the example, that so far as certain international crimes are concerned, those individuals already have responsibility under international law. Genocide is an example. But what I say to you is, when you already have, and again you gave examples of this, the duty of states to ensure rights, and that means to make sure by some form of due diligence test that they stop those rights being withheld or abused by others, and if that occurs to grant compensation and redress. Why, beyond that, does one need to identify what the individuals themselves are doing to those other individuals as a human rights violation rather than just unlawful? What is gained by the wife in marital rape or the examples you gave, bringing that claim as a rights abuse claim rather than saying that under the various discrete provisions of the law, whether assault or whatever statutory provisions there are, their legal rights are being violated, and that if the state is not in a general sense providing redress for this, or where it can, taking measures to prevent it, that the state is liable for human rights abuse. Why do we need to call the individual to individual level a rights abuse as well?
Thank you. Yes, these are... Is this working?
Well, yes. It is.
These are very tough questions. With regard to state functions, I think it's an error to go down the road of saying what is traditionally done by the state will be always covered by human rights, because it's precisely the ideological debate about what is the state and what the state should traditionally do, which you're then getting into. And what for one person is obviously to be traditionally done by the state, say the postal service, for another person is something which should not be done by the state. And you run into this particularly at the international level if you try to get the public-private distinction worked out in terms of what does the state do normally or traditionally. In Strasbourg or in New York, they're going to have such a conflict between all the different countries, whether they're socialist or quasi-socialist or communist or free market, that nobody will ever be able to agree what is traditionally done by the state, and you walk into a huge ideological minefield, and all you end up doing is just promoting your own view of what the state should do. So that's why I've avoided looking at that area. But what are the advantages of calling what one person does to another person human rights? Well, I don't know if anybody saw Catherine MacKinnon on BBC Two last night. I saw it, I came in late. And she used the expression human rights, I think, about 5 times in 5 minutes, very liberally, about what men do to women. And obviously it has a certain rhetorical value, and it means that you bring with you a whole sort of movement and you sort of elevate the abuse to what people consider very serious, which is abusing a political detainee. So it has a kind of political activist tool. But secondly, I think there are good legal reasons. First of all, you can't go to Strasbourg and say the state has an obligation to stop this human rights abuse unless you accept at the beginning that a man raping his wife is a human rights abuse, because the state can say, as they do say in Strasbourg, but this is private sphere, this is not us. So unless you admit from the very beginning that the individual is actually committing human rights abuse, the state won't feel obliged to stop it. And the third reason I give are the Canadian examples, whereas if you don't admit that me doing something to you is a human rights abuse, then I'm stopped from using that in the courts, whereas other people can attack legislation which protects me. Now, probably people aren't worried about me personally, but the examples I gave were the way it has worked against organized labor and the way it has worked against women, because there is legislation to protect those spheres, and yet as individuals or as groups, they were unable to rely on the Bill of Rights, while their opponents could. So that would be the answer.
Thank you very much. Yes. Could you be unconvinced loudly? Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Let's give Mr. Clapham a go to come back.
I'll have a go, yes. I didn't outline the legal framework of the rights that I was talking about. I'm really talking about the legal rights which you have under the European Convention on Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And those are much more than not, I mean, those are really rather concrete and not nonsense on stilts. I mean, that is a right which you have in law and which can be taken either to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, or if there was a Bill of Rights in this country, you would be able to apply it directly in the courts. So it would be much more than rhetoric, and it is much more than rhetoric. And in many cases, the Bill of Rights is actually applied by the judges here as part of the interpretation of British law or as part of common law or European community law and so on. So, I mean, I would say straight away, I'm not just talking about it at the rhetorical level. I was saying that using human rights adds to the weight of your political argument in some cases. But the starting point is those legal rights which you have. I think there may have been a misunderstanding on the question of the role of the state. I was saying that it's not worth going down that road because you do get bogged down in it. And there is no... No.
I think it's a response.
Right. Well, you may be right. I mean, maybe it's not a proper response. But the thing is that the way to think about human rights, I'm suggesting, is not to say it's governmental activity. And if Andrew Clapham is saying that things are being privatized, well, then it's traditional government activity, and we all know what governments do. I'm saying that you shouldn't start with that. You should say human rights attach to everybody. That's the way that they were conceived in the treaties. That's the way the law attaches. And that other issue is a side issue.
Right. Now, I've got a series of hands going up here first.
Yeah. I very much appreciate the talk that you delivered, and especially the desire to want to extend and deepen human rights. What I question is the tone and the tenor of the slogan, privatization of human rights. Because we're living in a time now where privatization, on the one hand, is directed at eliminating abusive state practices, interfering state practices, etc. The other side of that coin is the abdication of state responsibilities. And really, what's at the essence of what you're saying is that the state's role should be expanded. In other words, that the state should really be held accountable to enforce human rights throughout society. So that my first point is the tenor and the tone and the adoption of the slogan, the privatization of human rights, really appropriate here, and particularly in the current climate. The second part of the question is somewhat different, but it's connected. That in many parts of the world where there are zones, where there are major conflicts, where insurgency movements have grown up, and I know that Amnesty has recently changed its position on these questions, where insurgency movements have grown up against what is arguably unjust state action, when you put at the same level the call for the protection of human rights by non-government organizations, I think that can be morally justified. But at the same time, unless there's a tension and an equal call for the responsibility of states to respond to the source of those insurgencies, to the reasons why people rebel and revolt and take up arms, then one can actually, by entering and interfering in the debate between these two parties and calling to task the non-governmental party as well, one can reinforce situations of extreme unequal power. And how do you relate your premises to that kind of situation?
I agree with what you've just said. I mean, the term privatization was used as a controversial title to the lecture. I'm not suggesting it's a good slogan or that it explains everything that ought to be done. And I totally agree with you. The clue is not to privatizing more aspects of state responsibility, but actually asking the state to do more in the private sphere. So I agree, it's not an appropriate thing. But I was using it in this context, not only to cover the importance of looking at human rights abuses in that sphere, but also what is happening in that attention to human rights is also being privatized at the UN by allowing private companies to fund the scrutiny and so on. So it was to get at that double aspect. But I totally agree, it's inappropriate. It suggests that the state somehow has less to do, so it's wrong. And as for the insurgency groups and the importance of state responding, I agree. And I think you'll find that most human rights groups don't hold non-governmental entities and so on to the same standards. They hold them to the standards of international humanitarian law, of not taking hostages, of not torturing their prisoners, and so on. They wouldn't expect those groups to fulfill the state responsibility to provide health care and education and so on and so forth. So I agree with you.
Right, at the back.
Yes, the first part of my question was very much related to this. The slogan I would have thought would be much better for your talk would be the socialization. In fact, you're talking about extending the sphere of impact into society in general. And so, actually, my question was to put that forward as an alternative title, the slogan, to actually convey what I think you're trying to say, which I have agreed. And in relation to that, I wanted to ask a more specific question concerned with social rights, and the whole notion of social rights within human rights discourse. I want to know to what extent human rights thinkers, such as yourself, have really engaged in the whole debate around social development. And I want to ask quite a specific question with you as Amnesty representative of the UN, whether you're involved in the planning for the World Summit on Social Development, which I think is going to be quite a turning point in political policy formation at this time. Is the human rights community going to be there? And if so, is it doing its thinking in preparation for that? If this is it, I mean, I think it needs to be tightened.
This is not it. There is a lot of thinking going on about how to get a greater human rights dimension into the social summit. I myself am actually rather disappointed that more human rights groups are not approaching that in the same way that they approached Vienna. But because you don't have human rights in it and it's not like buzzing around, people are not interested. And it's a shame. And if you listen to the debate at the moment, it is very poor on the topic of human rights in the context of the social summit. There is now mounting a bit of activity. For example, the Economic and Social Rights Committee, at their last meeting, drafted a statement for that social summit, pleading that their body be given a greater role in the UN for monitoring, investigating, and upholding economic and social rights, because they have, well, it's complex within the UN system. They are a treaty body, but they're also a sub-body of the Economic and Social Council. So they can actually look at all countries, not just those countries that have chosen to ratify the treaties which they look at. And I think a lot of people feel that the direction is there. You may have seen in the paper today and also from the Human Development Report that people are again reviving Economic and Social Rights Council or Economic Social Security Council or something along those lines. And again, I think in the reform of the UN, the Security Council may now expand into that sphere. So there is a lot of thinking, but you're absolutely right. But I would throw it back and say it's also up to the academic community to like work in this area, because human rights activists, if you speak to them, and when I speak to my colleagues about why aren't we doing more on the social summit, they have like huge other problems going on in the world, and they say, well, isn't this just going to be another talk shop, and it's governments again, and why should we divert our resources from examining what's happening in Bosnia and Rwanda into sort of some rather abstract social development theories? So okay. That's where we are.
Right. Next, Professor Desai.
Yeah, two things. First of all, I think your focus on privatization of what is the content of it, I think it's very much in line with the new theory of the state, because basically what we are saying, including development, instead of being in the commanding heights of the economy, the state should be in health and education and welfare. It should not intervene in state, but an enabling state. In that respect, your emphasis in the state should look more after an extended bill of human rights. Would be entirely in agreement with the new view of the state. From that point of view, the state is privatized away from economic intervention, acquires obligations to be the enabling state in terms of human rights. And that clearly is not at variance with the new theories of the state action. But you said somewhere towards the end of your speech, but in some sense, the Lockean notion of human rights was tied into human rights with the state. And I think that's exactly the wrong way to proceed. The Lockean view of human rights is much more fundamental, because it is your right in your own body, basically. Your right in your own body is what gives you right to the fruits of your labor. They should define that as your private property right. That's a fundamental human right. But everybody has it in every transaction they enter into, whether with the state or with the private individual. That would be a perfectly good Lockean basis.
Right.
And then it is no longer a rhetoric, it is something founded in a human pocket.
I think that's great. I mean, obviously, a much more a deeper reading of Locke would give you that individual dignity that, you know, you have vis-a-vis the rest of the world, wherever they come from. The problem has been, I think, that a lot of feminists have come in and said, well, Locke only identified a man's world, and so on and so forth. And so that is why some of those other notions, and Rousseau and all that, have been sort of deemed as unhelpful, because they cut off the domestic sphere and the sphere of women and everything as something to be excluded from civil society or public discourse and so on. And so that is why I think I was sort of wary of those notions.
Right. I have you all well in mind next here. Yes. What do you say to that?
It's a very good question. It's the crux of it. And that's why I said you'd have to be careful about publicising the private and introducing a whole new range of state interference. I suppose the cynic in me would say that the state will interfere where it wants to interfere anyway. I'm just saying that don't say that somehow the private sphere is something that isn't touched by human rights, because in law it is. And by not allowing protection in that area, you run a very discriminatory line, and you say that women and the workplace and all that is somehow not of international concern. So I totally agree with you. It has to be done very carefully. I'm just saying that for consistency and in terms of law and in terms of some of the areas that get overlooked, human rights applies there equally. It doesn't mean that you take a fundamentalist approach and say that everybody has this right here and we have to actually do it. I mean, obviously there's going to be balances. All these rights are written in with provisos that you only have a right to freedom of expression as long as it doesn't interfere with somebody else's rights to privacy and so on and so forth. So the balancing act will always be there. I'm just saying that in law, human rights ought to be in that sphere.
Right. Then the next question is there. Yes, you.
Right.
Which in many respects retakes rights which are recognized or in our existing documents. But this specific.
Because that convention came much more recently, it's much more explicit about the fact that the obligations cover the public and the private spheres, and the state has an obligation in the private sphere in that convention, and states have signed on to it. So I think it's probably less controversial. It's some of the earlier human rights treaties, which are always considered to be only about the public sphere, that, for example, the the prohibition on inhumane treatment, which then people extrapolate and say, well, does that apply to a parent? That's more complex than the rights of the child obligation, where everybody knows that it does. The reason it's important to do it in the classical human rights context rather than the children's context is that there you can go to court on it, whereas you can't go to court on that right in the Child's Convention. You can't. There's no sort of individual complaint procedure, whereas in the ones I was talking about there is, so that's why it's more difficult.
Gentleman at the back.
I think that's a real point, yes. Some of the attack, the counter-attack, if you like, in the universality debate, which comes from some of the Asian or Latin American countries, they will say, the West has a vision of human rights which only applies to civil and political rights and applies to the public sphere. It does not affect migrant workers working in a sweatshop in downtown New York. That's human rights too, they will say. So in some way, now that we've moved away from privatization into socialization, it ought to actually undercut the opposition to the universality of human rights. If you say we are actually socializing human rights, we are taking them into the everyday and into the workforce and into these areas which you say the West ignores, then you may actually come to a meeting of minds. You would also come to the area which, again, people complain about, is that the West doesn't rely enough on the positive obligations of the state. And the socialist countries say human rights is about the obligations of the state to provide for people, whereas the West says it's to stop the state from doing something nasty. And again, by bringing in these positive obligations on the relationship between individuals, you may actually answer some of those ideological objections to human rights. So I would say you could actually use it the other way. Right, and it's there you're on the very edges of the difference between regional and international, in that the UK is probably the last country in Europe where you're whacked in school, and the rest of Europe is laughing at us and saying, well, we outlawed that ages ago, these are the barbarians. Whereas you're right, if you took it to the UN level in New York, they would say, well, this is totally frivolous. So that is why that case is interesting at the European level, but not at the international level.
Right, we'll take I've seen three more hands, and then we will bring the curtain down. First here.
The lecturer has stressed how the functions of the state, how many functions are being privatized. And this must make us wonder who in fact is governing us. Is it certain companies, is it certain multinationals? And the whole concept of the state must in fact be questioned. Are states as such being privatized? And are we going back to feudal times when you had dukes, private armies, dukes, private governments, and so on and so on? Are we really going back to all this? And if this distinction between private and the state is so blurred, then of course we must try to widen human rights to apply to both, if the state becomes something very uncertain.
Is the state a holding company?
I'm sure there are people in the room better equipped to answer this than me, but I have noticed that some of the deregulation, if you like, or privatization, has meant that the people who used to govern have put those functions into new, what are called quangos or bingos, and all these bodies which have been set up to regulate things, and are supposed to be private, but then a lot of people are put in who are really governmental people after all. And so it's sort of technically private, but actually rather governmental in a private kind of way. So I don't really know.
All right. You, yes.
You're right. Of course, I called it the public sphere or the public domain, and I meant that to be very different from the state domain. And it means public in the sort of widest senses of sort of public space, and public, I suppose, as opposed to intimate, rather than public as opposed to private or non-state. And sometimes there just doesn't seem to be enough words to like get these distinctions out, but it's really the distinction between an intimate sphere and a public domain, as opposed to relying on the old concepts of public and state and government. But I think exactly as was said before, that you need a way out of just having this huge kind of publicization of every aspect of our intimate and daily lives, and the state using this as an excuse to further interfere, as you said before. So you need some way out of that and some kind of conceptual framework to stop that from happening and sort of lay down some markers.
Right, final question of the evening.
That cuts to the heart of it. It's not, I think, even the European Court of Human Rights has said that it's not enough just to have the legislation. You need to have the finance and so on and so forth, and the organization to make the rights effective. So that when a woman wanted to get divorced from her husband who was beating her in Ireland, she claimed it was an invasion of her privacy, and technically she could do it. The legislation was there, but there wasn't the money for her to brief a lawyer to get the right enforced, and the court came down and said it's not just a question of having the legislation, it has to be an effective protection of your right. So now I think there's education and finance and so on, it has to go beyond legislation.
Right. Well, we will be able to continue in the private domain our conversation with Andrew Clapham, because there will be now upstairs in the Graham Wallace room, which is on the fifth floor, a reception, and we'll have a chance to talk informally there. In the meantime, before we continue that sort of dialogue, I think, Andrew, you can see very easily the fact that for well over half an hour now, people have had many observations and comments to make and questions to put to you, and how much that illustrates how interesting everyone has found your talk. Thank you very much for providing us with such a stimulating lecture. The porter at the door there will tell you the preferred way up to the Graham Wallace room.